on digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
So the Llama Tree Festival, what happens there then?
We're in the Llama Tree Gardens, which some people may know because Ken Russell has filmed it. It's these beautiful gardens. I've been coming here for quite a long time playing stuff with the Dodge Brothers. And this year I've been programming this film strand. And actually, Simon, you would have loved it because last night we showed Hackers and tomorrow we've got a brand new print of Dougal and the Blue Cat,
which
I think is one of the greatest films ever made. But unfortunately, you didn't enjoy as much as I did when I had it as my Radio 1 leaving thing. And then on Sunday, we're playing this Louise Brooks movie, Beggars of Life, and we're playing along to accompany it. It's a silent film, and the Dodge Brothers are playing along to accompany it with Neil Brand, the pianist. So it's, you know, it's basically the idea of taking a film strand out to a festival and putting music and film together, and it's very good, and you're sorely missed, but it's all going terrifically well. Oh, we played Slade in Flame last night as well, and that was another big hit, because nobody believes me that Slade in Flame is a really, really great movie until they actually sit down and watch it. And it was very good because at the beginning of the film I said, has anybody here seen this film before? And one person said, yeah, I've seen it before and it's not very good. I said, okay, let me explain to you why you're wrong and why it's actually a masterpiece. And then we played the whole film. I explained to him why it was great, and at the end he agreed with me that I was right and he was wrong, and it was in fact a masterpiece.
It's actually your perfect festival, really. Just, you know,
it is.
You can adopt the same kind of condescending tone to a live audience and win them round. Hey, presto, fine.
And I get to play the double bass at them as well. So it's all the things I love together at once. It's skiffle, it's movies, and it's me explaining why people haven't yet understood what their response to a film should be. But it was really nice seeing Hackers play so well because, as you remember, when Hackers came out in the mid-90s, I think it was Film of the Month at Radio 1, but it was sorely overlooked by everybody. It's a very early performance by Johnny Lee Miller. In fact, it was the movie on which Johnny Lee Miller and Angelina Jolie met, because I think they were briefly together. I mean, I think they were married, actually.
Yes, well, I think you're probably right on that. But you can get it on DVD, and the soundtrack is excellent as well. This is, of course, the show and the podcast, which has been proved over the last couple of weeks to save lives. And we just need to update you on that. Ned in York, dear Bob and Helen, I listened to last week's podcast with an increasing sense of insecurity. It seems that nowadays, to prove you are really a fan of the programme, you have to put your life in jeopardy and then use Wittertainment to save it. Surely even now across Britain, people are tying themselves to train tracks, hoping that laughter induced by a Commodian rant will provide sufficient movement to wriggle free before a train comes. Where will it end? I'm still loving the obvious tagline thing, by the way. Surprised no one has suggested one for the Bob Hoskins classic, The Long Good Friday. And I'm suggesting, says Ned, it's dragging on a bit, but at least Easter is in a couple of days. Tone in Nottingham. Having neither had my life saved by your podcast or put in danger by it, I'm becoming increasingly worried about whether to carry on listening. Do I need to listen in case it saves my life, or do I risk a terrible injury by continuing to subscribe? Could you advise, please? What do you think?
Well, I think we should be clear that if you in any way deliberately endanger yourself in the hope that Wittertainment will save your life, it doesn't count.
No, okay, yes, because that just counts as being stupid, doesn't it? Okay, fine.
Yeah, it has to be completely incidental.
Tone also says, just noticed that at the end of the podcast, Mark advertises his uncut blog. Does he also have a cut blog somewhere? If not, he could save himself a whole lot of effort and just call it a blog. Love the show, Steve. Why is it an uncut blog then?
Well, that's just the name of it. It's called Kermode Uncut. But somebody put on Wittertainment, don't say that anywhere near Danny Dyer, because he might have any other ideas.
Ruth Gard.
So, but that's just the name of the blog.
Ruth Gard, B.A. Cantab, M.A. Lond. Incidentally, she says, you haven't saved my life as such, but you have made the last 6 months of night feeds for my baby something to look forward to rather than dread. Your podcast is my favourite, along with the World Cup Daily, of which Dr. K undoubtedly is an avid fan.
Just to give you a little bit of flow, I'm looking out of the 5 Live radio broadcast van at the moment at David Braithwaite walking up a path in flip-flops with shorts holding a moving portable toilet. It's a move for some time.
The only problem with that is, of course, is that we can barely hear what you're saying. What happens is it sounds as though there is a censor who's decided to cut out every fourth word that you say. And the bizarre thing is it actually makes more sense this way.
I will have a technical...
Yep, that's not getting any better, is it? Now let's try again to speak to Mark at the Llama Tree Festival, where reception has been oh so glorious so far. Let's try again.
I believe I am back. Are you now hearing every word or only every word in four?
Every word so far. So why don't we do a box office top 10 and let's sort of... we'll leave a bit of flim-flam towards the end in case it all just explodes.
Excellent. Can I say before we do the top 10 that there are two Bollywood movies in the top 10 that weren't national press screened? So reviews, short reviews of I Hate Love Stories from last week. I think we may have a review from last week. And also Melange, which I am reliably informed is a delayed Bollywood film inspired by 2001 Serendipity. So either of those two short reviews, please.
OK. Yes, to 85058 or mayo@bbc.co.uk. So the Melange, the previously mentioned, is at number 10. Prince of Persia, Sands of Time is at number 9.
Which is perfectly fine. Shorter and better than Pirates of the Caribbean.
Never Trust a Bald Man in Mascara.
I
Hate Love Stories is at 8. So Heartbreaker at 7.
Which is a very peculiar thing. I am convinced that one of the reasons that's got the kind of reviews that it has is because it's French. If it was just, you know, an English language comedy, everyone would see it for what it was, which is a total piece of fluff. And the story is that this guy is somebody who's brought in to break up relationships that are bad relationships, but he only does it with a certain moral code. And yet, of course, as the movie plays out, you realise he's going to fall for the person whose relationship he's meant to break up. I mean, thinking this is total fluff, the message of which is the key woman has to break up with the gentleman to whom she is betrothed because he's English, and that's his main crime, that's his main fault, and it is total fluff, but it's in French, so consequently people have said, oh, it's intelligent and, you know, witty and sophisticated.
There must be a French word for fluff.
Le fluff.
And if there is a French word for fluff, it's almost certainly referred to in La Blonde or Seine Nue, if you remember from last week.
Yes.
The blonde who takes her top off. She's blonde. She takes a top of it. It's actually not in the top 10, disappointingly. Sex and the City 2 at 6.
I think we've said everything that has to be said about Sex and the City 2. I mean, the fact that it's still in it's number 6 means that it has made a huge amount of money. And there was an announcement shortly after the film opened that because of the bad box office and the terrible reviews, they weren't going to make Sex and the City 3. It's worrying that because it's there at number 6, they might, I think, now be encouraged to do another one.
Killers is at 5.
Which is nothing like as funny as it ought to be. I really wanted to enjoy it. I like the idea of, you know, counter World Cup programming, even now that the World Cup is gone. But it's, you know, it's just nothing like as funny as it needs to be.
Get Him to the Greek is at number 4.
Which is fine. Again, I think it doesn't fully exploit Russell Brand's comic potential. I mean, it's funny. A couple of people wrote in and said, how come when you're so down on things like, you know, The Hangover, you don't have the same objections to Get Him to the Greek that it's a Boise match? I don't think it is. I think it's actually more than that. But I think Russell Brand has the potential to be much funnier than this. He is currently involved in a remake of Arthur, which worries me enormously because I really like the original Arthur. I think Arthur is a terrific movie. I thought it was really, really funny. And I've, you know, I can recite huge sections of the screenplay. So the very idea that anyone is remaking Arthur does worry me, but it is a good vehicle.
Now, Predators is a new entry at number 3. Interesting text here from David in Stroud. Some friends and I went to see Predator last night. Predators, of course. I posted on my Facebook page, says David in Stroud, that I thought it was a bit pants. In result of this, I now have what can only be described as all-out war between one group saying it didn't do the original justice and another saying it's great and will now introduce a new group of teenage boys to the world of sci-fi geekiness that we now enjoy. Could the good doctor please put us straight once and for all and save my Facebook page for the usual pictures of drunken knights and pointless statue updates? Oh, sorry, status updates. Sorry about that.
The statues updated. The thing with Predators is it is the second best Predator movie. Although, funnily enough, I was in the pub the other day and I said, oh, Predator's the second best Predator movie. And somebody said, no, Predator 2 is actually the second best Predator movie. It's a really great... And it's. I mean, I have to go back and look at Predator 2 again. I don't remember it being particularly good. I just remember it being Predator Goes to the City. The thing with Predators is it isn't anything more than a kind of series reboot. And it reminds you of the things that were quite jolly about the first Predator. And the first Predator was in itself pretty derivative and pretty much a, you know, straightforward rubber monster movie with one gimmick, which is that the Predator is invisible and he can't see you when you're covered in mud. So I think that what, you know, Robert Rodriguez, you know, producing this as a series reboot, it is perfectly fine, but it is nothing more than perfectly fine. It's certainly not terrible. It's certainly nothing like as bad as the Alien versus Predator movies, which are absolutely ghastly. I do think it was better than Predator 2, but not as good as Predator. But I don't think the original Predator was any masterpiece. It's certainly not up there with Aliens or anything like that. So it's the second best of something that was only all right to start with.
Thank you. I don't suppose you can identify that interesting bird that seems to be circling your wagon.
It's a peacock.
Is it?
A peacock. Yeah, there are peacocks wandering around the garden. It's very, very peculiar. And it was just wandered past the side of the van, looked in. You know, I think it was disagreeing with my review of Predators. That's a peacock. They make a very particular sound. It's arr, arr. Actually, funnily
enough...
Add that
to the list of impressions.
Yeah, no, but a peacock can actually sound like somebody calling out. Like somebody calling out your name. It's really bizarre.
Yeah. No, it can't, actually. But anyway, thank you for that. So, Shrek Forever After, is it too much better than you're about to say it is, I think?
Well, no, they should. Yeah, have you seen it?
No, I can just tell.
Yeah, no, well, they should have stopped at... actually, they should have stopped at two. Shrek was fine. Well, actually, Shrek was great. Shrek 2 was fine. Shrek 3 felt like that was the end of the line. Shrek 4 Ever After, which incidentally on all the posters is referred to as Shrek the Final Chapter, it really feels like the most overly flogged of dead horses. I mean, it's not terrible. It's just not any good. And when you remember just how much fun the original Shrek was, there really isn't any excuse for this being quite so lackluster.
I quite like the idea, which I mentioned by mistake, the statue update on Facebook. I think you should do that. If you have a Facebook page, you should put, never mind status update, you should just maybe include a photograph of your favourite statue and tell us of its most recent condition. I reckon that might work.
Okay.
Apparently, you've got lots and lots of Facebook pages. A number of listeners have been pointing out. All of them, I suspect, unofficial. Anyway, Shrek Forever is at two. Twilight Saga Eclipse is at number one. Couple of emails on this. First of all, dear Team Edward and Team Jacob, I recently very much enjoyed watching Eclipse. Agree with the Good Doctor's view that it centres on Bella's exploration of who she is. However, I would have preferred it if her options in life were less closely correlated to which boyfriend she chooses. Indeed, I would have enjoyed a focus on the largely ignored option to be single and spend time with her awesome friends, who seem to have the insight that she lacks.
Well, I think the key thing about the Twilight Saga, and particularly about Eclipse, is it is, in the end, about Bella making decisions about her own life. There is a key line in it in which she, when she's talking to Edward, and she's going on about wanting to be a vampire, and she says, it's nothing to do with being with you, it's to do with being who I am. And I think that, I mean, there's been an awful lot of stuff in the press in the last week analysing what Twilight allegedly stands for, and what values Twilight allegedly holds up. And there was one article that was headlined something like, how Twilight ate feminism, and it's
that would be the Guardian then.
I'm not sure that it was the Guardian. It was some, you know, intellectual academic waffle, and it was somebody taking, you know, totally out of context a bunch of plot points and saying, well, this proves this and this proves this and this proves this. In the end, the fact that people, you know, want to interpret this in as many ways, fine, great, whatever interpretation you have, that's perfectly fine. I don't see any of that stuff in it. And you like the Twilight stuff, right? You liked Eclipse.
Oh, yeah, I haven't seen the third one yet, but I thought the first two were excellent. And if this is better than those other two, then that's fine. Except that everyone I know who likes it has already seen it. And as we mentioned last week, I don't want to go and see it on my own for fears of strange looks. And I'm certainly not going to see it with you, because that would be even stranger.
No, but it's fine, because Boyd Hilton said that he'd come and see it with us, so the three of us can go.
Oh, that'll
look even
worse.
It could be a night out for you, me and Boyd.
Jordan in Enfield. I felt compelled to email you after something strange happened to me the other day. After happily winding up two female colleagues about Twiglet, a pastime I'm quite fond of, they put me in the awkward position of handing me the DVD and telling me to watch it. Seeing as my wife is currently reading the books, and that her latest comment was that they make Harry Potter seem intellectual, I decided to give it a shot, mainly to greatly increase my ammunition when I tell people how terrible it is. The problem was that I actually quite liked it. It was not what I expected at all. The acting was a bit flat in parts. The MTV Europe vampires annoyed me, and the CGI jumpy running Edward bits made me laugh out loud. But apart from that, I found myself engaged with the characters, and it left me wanting to watch the second one. This isn't the kind of film I generally like. Give me a zombie apocalypse any day. But to be fair, it wasn't what I assumed it would be. I suppose I better go and rent New Moon. There you go. The inconvenience of actually having to watch the thing that you've got an opinion on.
I know, but I should also say that the thing is, if you see New Moon, I mean, New Moon is in a way that the narratively difficult one, because for so much of it, Edward is out of the picture, and New Moon is the one that people who pick on the Twilight series say, oh, it's all about Bella moping, because she does do some interstellar moping in New Moon. Eclipse, however, I think is quantifiably different in that she takes a much more active role. Also, I think I just think David Slade is a very fine director, and if you're somebody who likes zombie apocalypse and all that stuff, remember, David Slade is the guy who made 30 Days of Night. He's a proper, you know, full-on horror film director, and he understands movie making. There's a film out this week called Rap, which is the new thriller by Lucas Belvo, and is very, very intelligent. The story is a French film. Story is the president of a very powerful corporation is kidnapped and a ransom issued for 50 million euros. What you imagine is going to then be a sort of straightforward crime drama actually turns into something else, because whilst he's kidnapped, the police investigate his life and discover all these things about his private life that nobody knew. The fact that he had mistresses, the fact that he had a terrible gambling habit, the fact that most of his fortune has been squandered, the fact that his family discover that he's not the person that they thought he was. So whilst he is being held as a hostage, the outside world, his image, or he's holding together quite well as a hostage, but the outside image of him is falling apart, his press scandals, and it's all about the way in which the people who are meant to be paying the ransom start debating as to whether or not they should pay the ransom, how much of the ransom they can pay. The company that he works for starts to conclude very rapidly that he's actually not worth paying the ransom for, and perhaps life would be better if they didn't pay the ransom and he didn't come back. And it's 2 hours long, and the time positively flies by. It's a film that's full of ideas. It's got a very, very sort of cold, icy, sort of sardonic tone to it. Very, very well acted. Plays out in ways which you don't expect, gripping and, you know, thoroughly worth seeing. But the thing which I really enjoyed this week, which is a French, Italian, Romanian, Russian co-production, which is this film called Le Concert, The Concert. And the story is that there is this guy working at the Bolshoi who used to be a great conductor but was unable to carry on conducting because he had a row with the authorities about employing Jewish musicians, and ends up having a job as a cleaner. Through bizarre means, he ends up intercepting a fax in which the Bolshoi Orchestra get asked to go and play at the Châtelet in Paris, and he gets all his friends together and says, look, I'll tell you what, I've got this fax, why don't we all get together, reclaim our jobs, go to Paris and put on this concert? So it's kind of a fantasy, and it's a screwball fantasy about all these people who were at once great musicians who have now been completely sidelined through this horrible political shenanigans, getting themselves together and getting themselves to France to put on this concert, where, incidentally, our hero said, there is a soloist that I want to play for reasons which are partly musical and partly personal. There's a whole sort of personal discovery drama going on. It's really interesting because it looks at the beginning like it's going to be a pretty ramshackle, screwball, you know, let's put the show on here kind of story. And of course, mechanically, it virtually makes no sense at all. The idea of this orchestra getting themselves together to put on this huge concert is fantastical. But as it played out, I became increasingly swept up in it. It's got a lovely performance by Melanie Laurent, who was the second best thing about Inglourious, the Quentin Tarantino movie. She was the second best thing after Christoph Waltz. She's the woman who runs the cinema in Paris that they try and put on the Nazi premiere at. And she gives a really sparkling central performance. And it all ends up with this question of whether or not they'll be able to get the orchestra together to do the gig. And I have to say that much as my rational brain was going, oh, this is nonsense, this is flimsy, this is manipulative, this is soggy, actually, my heart completely went with it, and as the music started to surge, I found myself being increasingly swept along with it, and as the closing credits, I was in tears. I really, really enjoyed it. It was one of those things in which your head says no, but your heart says go with it, and I had a really good time in the concert.
So, Inception and Toy Story 3 to come. Just a couple of quick comments here. Randall, listening live in St. Paul, Minnesota. The peacock there, Mark, sounds a lot like McGee. Now we know the good doctor has been using his peacock voice when he says it. So the peacock and McGee are the same. But before you comment, Sarah Shorter, is it me or does Mark's peacock sound rather like his Danny Dyer? So that peacock is clearly a podcast listener and has combined both voices to come up with his peacock noise.
The peacock doing impressions back at me.
And Jasjit Singh from the University of Leeds is pointing out that Melange, which we were talking about before, he said your French pronunciation of that isn't really strictly correct, given that Melange means we'll meet again in Punjabi and Hindi and is kind of pronounced Milangay.
Okay. Oh, I beg your pardon.
So it's Milangay. Jasjit, thank you very much indeed for the correction. This text says, Mark should be watching the truly amazing Walshan Pound, currently playing the Ark stage at Larmatry, banjo and harmonica wizardry. So when you finish, that's where to go.
There's been a lot of good banjo and harmonica stuff going on. I saw earlier on Owl in the Sun, who are this band who I like very much, who I introduced Bob Harris to, in fact. And he's been playing their album. They were playing for. They had both banjo and indeed harmonica. But ask me which film I'm going to be introducing this afternoon.
Do I have to? Okay. What
yeah, go
film?
On.
Why don't you just tell us? Okay, what film?
Mary Poppins.
Oh, good.
Mary Poppins. We got a special screening of Mary Poppins, which remains one of my favourite films of all time, now, followed by a screening of Brazil.
Right, okay. So, look, we got 33 minutes. What do you want to do here? Do you want
well,
to
let's start with Inception, okay, because there's I think there's quite a lot of ground to cover with Inception, so I think we should give it the time that it's due. And then Toy Story 3, and then possibly Captain Brayat's Bluebeard, if time allows.
Okay, Inception then. Got loads of emails. A lot of people have seen it already, the various preview screenings. You'll have had a flavour of it as well, because Cillian Murphy was on the programme last week. But the review, the nuts and bolts thereof, the verdict goes like this.
Okay, so the latest film from Christopher Nolan, who effectively made $1 billion for Warner Brothers with The Dark Knight, and this very much looks like Warner said to him, okay, you made us $1 billion, go do whatever you want. So the story is that Leonardo DiCaprio works in the area of psychological espionage, getting inside people's minds to unlock and perhaps safeguard their secrets. And bear in mind, this is a complicated plot. I'll just explain as much of it as possible. He's got a secret of his own because following the untimely death of his wife, he has been unable to go home to where his children are because somehow he has been implicated in her death. A very powerful businessman comes to him and offers him as a proposition a job which apparently will solve all his problems. But the job is to do something which no one's quite sure whether you can do it, which is inception, which is not just to get inside somebody's mind, in this case Cillian Murphy's mind, but to implant in their mind an idea which that person will then think is their own. So as you can see, and as the tagline explains, this summer the crime scene is your mind. So it's a psychological thriller, it's an espionage thriller, it's in some respects a sort of James Bond action thriller, all taking place in the mind of its protagonist, of the Cillian Murphy character. So in order to do this last job, which will somehow redeem him and save him if he can pull off the impossible, he must get together a team of people to create a dream in which this espionage can be carried out. And in doing so, he goes back to a familiar face to say, I need to get a team together, here's a clip.
I think I found a way home. It's a job for some very, very powerful people. People who I believe can fix my charges permanently. But I need your help.
You're here to corrupt one of my brightest and best.
You know what I'm offering? You have to let them decide for themselves.
Money.
Not just money. You remember. It's the chance to build cathedrals, entire cities, things that never existed, things that couldn't exist in the real world.
So you want me to let someone else follow you into your fantasy?
They don't actually come into the dream. They just design the levels and teach them to the dreamers. That's all.
Design it yourself.
Ma won't let me.
Come back to reality, Tom.
Those kids, your grandchildren, they're waiting for their father to come back home. That's their reality. And this job, this last job, that's how I get there. I need an architect who's as good as I was.
I've got somebody better.
And that somebody better, of course, turns out to be Ellen Page. So, when Cillian Murphy came on the show last week, he was very, very keen that, we didn't reveal more details of the plot than necessary. I think it's weird because you and I have had a conversation, Simon, about how much you need to know before you see the film. I know you've seen it, so I'll tell you what I think first. I think on one level this is Dreamscape with A-levels, and I think that's a very good thing because I always like Dreamscape. On another level it's like a Bond movie. It's like on Her Majesty's psychiatric service. It's a Bond movie taking place in somebody's head. It's what's really interesting is that in Batman Begins, I think what you saw there was a $100 million art movie. And in the case of this, you've got a really, really expensive blockbuster that is every bit as complicated as something like Memento. And I remember when I saw it, and I've seen it twice now, when I saw it the first time, I thought, what's extraordinary is for a film that costs this much money, to ask the audience to try this hard to keep up is really impressive, because it is a movie in which you absolutely cannot go to the toilet. The advice that you need to know for this is make sure you are not going to require a toilet break, because if you go out for 2 or 3 minutes, you're going to come back in, you're going to be completely lost. There is one lovely line in it, which I've quoted before, in which Ellen Page's character actually says, sorry, whose subconscious are we in at the moment? And
every layer of the film makes sense in that puzzle way that Memento does, but you really, really have to try hard to keep up. It looks fantastic. It's shot by Wally Pfister, who, of course, now is known as this great blockbuster cinematographer. Wally Pfister started out shooting straight-to-video erotic thrillers for Greg Dark. He was a man about whom Sight and Sound once said, there's a man who knows how to light underwear. And he's now lighting the biggest, you know, movies in the world. And the film looks fantastic. The special effects are really exciting. I mean, obviously, some of it is digital. When you see, like, you will have seen this from the trailers, things of street scenes folding in upon themselves. But what's really impressive is how much of that stuff is done mechanically. And Christopher Nolan has said that the reason he wanted to do it mechanically was because when you're in the dream world, he wanted the actor to have a sense of the physical reality of it. Otherwise, it would cease to have any heft, any weight. And I think that's a very sensible decision. Some of the stuff you see, like the scene again, which is in the trailer of the corridor, which appears to go into zero gravity, that's a mechanical trick. I mean, obviously there is CGI work in it, but that's done mechanically, and I think that pays off. Leonardo DiCaprio is really growing up very nicely. I mean, he's actually turned into a very impressive actor. Ellen Page is terrific. Cillian Murphy has that really sort of strange, ethereal, slightly fractured quality. Oh, incidentally, hello to Cillian Murphy, because I think we should add him to the list of hello to Jason Isaacs and hello to David Morrissey, who you're doing on stage over the weekend.
Now, I keep telling you this. I'm interviewing Paul Greengrass at Latitude.
Oh, Paul Greengrass. Why do I keep thinking it's David Morrissey?
Because you're a fool.
Okay, you're doing Paul Greengrass, but hello to Paul Greengrass, hello to David Morrissey, but particularly hello to Cillian Murphy. And finally, before I give you your say on this, two last things. Firstly, Chris Nolan said that he was asked to look at it in 3D, and in the end, the road that he's gone down is IMAX, and he thinks, it seems, that he has the same reservations about 3D that I have, that that actually the dimness is a problem, and in fact, the IMAX experience is much more immersive, and I agree with that. The other thing is, the question of whether or not this will make enough money to be genuinely a blockbuster, and I really hope it does, because wouldn't it be great if a movie this complicated, if a movie that aims this high, if a movie that treats its audience as being this smart actually took a huge amount of money, there would be no excuse for Hollywood bosses to say, oh, well, we had to dumb it down to get a mainstream audience. If this gets a huge mainstream audience, it will demonstrate that the studios have been wrong in assuming that somehow people want dumb movies, that actually people are able to keep up. If a film says, come on, do the legwork, put the hours in, engage your brain, then it's going to work. And the other key question is, when you look at something like Titanic, which was a massive, massive hit, it was a huge hit because of repeat viewing. And one of the things people said about this is, well, it won't have the same repeat viewing because people went to see Titanic over and over again because they loved the tragic love story. I suggest that people will go and see Inception more than once, because you come out of it the first time and go, okay, now I need to go back and watch it again in the same way as Memento to see if it really fits together in the way that I thought it did. I thought it was Knockout, and I was really impressed that a movie that's that big and that expensive aimed that high. Simon, your verdict.
All right, so now it's my turn, even though we're 6 minutes late for the travel. So what I'll do is I'll just say one thing, and we'll take some travel, then we'll do some listeners' emails on this. And everyone knows how boring you are when you go on about 3D. However, on this particular film, you do leave it, I think everyone will think this, there are so many dimensions within the film that if it was projected in 3D, it would just be too much and would be a whole lot less enjoyable, which is something. Rob Howard on this, Dear Architect and Extractor. You have to see the film together. I was lucky enough to get along to an advanced screening of Inception at the IMAX on Monday, which is when I saw it, and it completely blew my mind, said Rob. I'd heard very little about the film before I saw it, but I've loved everything that Christopher Nolan has done before, and I was aware that for once this was a film not based on an existing franchise or a sequel, but an actual original idea conceived by Nolan himself. As a result, I didn't really know what to expect other than a solidly delivered movie with a more than capable lead performance from DiCaprio. What I got was something truly sublime, says Rob. The concepts took almost the length of the movie to fully digest, but I did, as Dr. K recommended, keep up with the plot, which slotted together awesomely. Having read the prequel comic, my suspicions of a Matrix-like universe expansion potential seem to have been confirmed. Hopefully, they don't make a similar mess out of it. Movie of the year, without a doubt, says Rob. Dan in Stoke Newington. Chris Nolan should be commended for his ambition and admirable attempts to present present us with innovative ideas on screen. However, he has overextended himself with Inception. It felt like the director had obsessively devoured a library on psychology and the dream-reality dichotomy, but had not quite decided where he sat on the issue. The resulted muddled, overly talky screenplay felt like a second draft, as if the dialogue was actually Nolan's own internal monologue. He was wrestling with the material and trying to figure out what his own thoughts were on the material. Mark. Hello, Mark.
Hi, sorry, I lost you at the end of that email. I think.
Had you nodded off just because it was my bit? I mean, I sit here to you, and I get to read two emails for a bit, and you're just going to get distracted and read the paper.
I lost the signal, which is coming into me via a mobile phone, Simon. If I may answer both of those. The first one I agree with entirely. As far as the second one's concerned, I don't think it read like a second draft screenplay. In fact, I think what was impressive about it was that there was fairly little Basil exposition stuff. I didn't think there was huge sections of people explaining the plot to each other. I didn't think it was overly talky. Actually, what's quite clever about it is that an awful lot of what it does conceptually, it does visually. I mean, it is, in the end, a film that is a film rather than a film that is an essay. I understand that there, when I was watching it, I thought there will be a certain section of the audience that will be alienated by this because it seems so fantastically convoluted. But after a while, the convolutions actually start to ease up because you just start to relax into the various levels. We haven't really sort of talked about this since you've seen it. I know that you enjoyed it. Did you have any trouble keeping up with it?
I think there is a section, it takes about half an hour. It's a bit like getting used to hearing someone speak in a strong accent. It takes about 20 minutes, half an hour to get into the rhythm and to understand the language of the film. But the most complex bit, as we described last week, is where they're inside Cillian Murphy's head and they go down the different levels of the dream. So they're in a dream, then they go into another dream, and then they go into another dream. And you do find yourself thinking, right, that bit there with the truck, that's the level one, that bit there is level two. But I think that works. And in fact, there's an email here from Martin Hager in Nottingham, whose concluding point is, the plot is labyrinthine in construction, but he says you feel that getting lost is purposeful, and at no time do you feel that the film is losing its way. And I think he's right that if you feel a bit lost, I think that's fine. I think you're supposed to, because as Cillian Murphy said last week, when they picked up the scripts to start with, they didn't have a clue what was going on either. So I think if you get lost, you're getting lost in good company and to a purpose.
I think that's a very, very insightful email. I also think that that's part of the plot, because part of the story is about the characters getting lost themselves and actually not knowing which level they're in. As I said, that Ellen Page line about, you know, sorry, whose subconscious are we in at the moment? That's not just said as a nod to the audience. It is because a central theme of the film is you forget where you are in this. And the whole sort of central thing going on with the Leonardo DiCaprio character is whether or not he really is in control of the various levels of the dream, or whether he has been seduced by his own creation. I mean, one of the nice little plot points is when he's explaining to Ellen Page how you go about creating the architecture of a dream, he says, you mustn't ever use anything that you know from the real world. And she says, well, why not? You have to work from your own memories. He says, no, because the minute you do that, that's a surefire way of losing the distinction between what is real and what is imagined, which I thought was a lovely little plot detail. Don't put architecture in of buildings that really exist, because if you do, you'll start wandering around the dream and wondering whether it's a dream or the real world. So I think that whole idea about you getting lost, about it being labyrinth, I mean, that's exactly what it is. It is, you know, it's that maze structure, it's the puzzle structure, it's the Rubik's Cube structure, that there is a point to all that, and the idea of being lost in it kind of is the point of the film.
And I do think you were initially not sure as to whether it was an art movie with lots of action sequences, as to whether it was an action movie which had...
with lots of art.
Lots of art in it. But I think one of the other points in Martin Hager's email is he says, it is an intelligent, gripping and highly entertaining blockbuster. And I think that's what it is. And I think it will make money, because although you have to work hard, it repays it a hundredfold. So my guess would be... it's a hit and will make tons of cash. Samir in Nuneaton says, I think the best thing about the movie is its execution. This is a film on a huge scale that is full of ideas and layers, but the most enjoyable thing about it is how it's laid out. Rules are set and then broken. The opening scene is a warning to you to pay attention. The final scene draws you in so much that by the time you get to the plane scene, the payoff is a huge relief and reward for going through all the complications. I don't think that's given too much away, is it?
No, it's not. But I mean, I also think it's worth saying, you know, people have talked about completely new idea. I mean, the idea of things taking place in dreams is not a completely new idea, but that doesn't matter. I mean, I, you know, we mentioned movies like Dreamscape, and certainly if you've seen films like Dreamscape, you'll be familiar with the concepts. If you looked at certain episodes of The Twilight Zone, that doesn't matter. What's interesting is that Christopher Nolan is taking an idea which has often, you know, interested fantasy filmmakers and science fiction filmmakers particularly, and is just being thorough with it. And I think that's absolutely right. And I also think that the key to it there, that the beginning sort of tells you what you need to know. The beginning tells you don't trust what you're watching, because, you know, you may be in any version of reality. So that's it. The film tells you to be on guard. The film tells you to keep up. The film allows you to think. And I just think that if a blockbuster that allows you to engage your brain properly makes millions of dollars, from an industrial point of view, that will be a good thing. It will mean there will be no excuse for simply making Pirates of the Caribbean 4, because it's like, no, people want more than that.
A lot of people, Mark, have very, very high expectations of this film. Toy Story 2, I think, from our general conversation over the last 10 years, better than Toy Story 1. Toy Story 2, a perfect film. What on earth can they do with Toy Story 3?
Well, it's very interesting because, of course, Toy Story 1 and 2 follow the Godfather mold, that 1 was great, but 2 somehow managed to be better. Of course, as everybody knows, with 3, even though I actually quite like Godfather 3, the general feeling was that it was a late entry and it dropped the ball. So in the case of Toy Story 3, is it going to stay in line with Godfather and somehow fall below par? So the story is this time, the years have moved on. Andy is preparing to go to college. The toys are preparing either to be taken with him, which seems unlikely, or to be put in a dusty box up in the attic, which seems possible, or to go out in the trash, which is of course possible, or to find a new home in a children's daycare center. I think we have time for this, so here's a clip.
Mr. Lotso, do toys here get played with every day?
All day long, 5 days a week.
But what happens when the kids grow up?
Well, now I'll tell you. When the kids get old, new ones come in. When they get old, new ones replace them. You'll never be outgrown or neglected, never abandoned or forgotten. No owners means no heartbreak.
Yee-haw! It's a miracle!
And you wanted us to stay at Andy's.
Because we're Andy's toys!
Now, of course, it's no surprise to know that actually there's a dark side to all of this. And here's what I think about Toy Story 3. It's made in 3D, it's designed in 3D, and I saw it in 3D, and it's the first time I've seen a 3D movie in which I actually forgot that I was watching it in 3D. I've spoken briefly to the director and indeed to the 3D supervisor, both of whom say, well, the whole point is we wanted you to forget it was in 3D, because as soon as you're aware of the 3D, it takes you out of the illusion of it, and what we really want you to do is just to be immersed in the story. And I was immersed in it. I can't decide whether I was immersed and forgot the 3D because the 3D is so unintrusive, or because, as with all the Toy Story movies, the characters are so well drawn, the animation is so beautiful, the pacing is so pitch perfect, and the audacity of the themes is so broad that you just simply forget that you're watching a mechanical construction. As with all the best best Toy Story things, this is essentially a story which works for kids perfectly well, but is every bit as much a story for grown-ups. One of the things I always hated about, for example, the Shark Tales films, the Shark Tale movie was, you know, it's a kids movie, but it just had some adult gags about the Godfather and Goodfellas thrown in. It's like, oh, well, the parents are going to be bored. Here's something for them. Here you have a story which means every bit as much, I believe, to grown-ups as it does to kids. I mean, it's about the idea that kids grow out of toys, and therefore it's facing ideas of abandonment, of, you know, of possible death, of destruction, and yet it's doing it in a way which is completely universally palatable. I would in fact argue that the idea of the toys being abandoned by the kid who is growing up would in fact mean more to somebody who has already put those things away, to, you know, to a grown-up, than it might do to a kid. Simon, you know the final chapter of Winnie the Pooh? You've read Winnie the Pooh, right?
Not for a decade or so.
Okay, well, the final chapter of Winnie the Pooh, which is really bizarre, and any parent who's ever read Winnie the Pooh to their kids will know this. It's a really strange chapter in which Christopher Robin takes Winnie the Pooh off to a certain area in the Hundred Acre Wood and kind of explains to him in vague terms that he's growing up and that he's growing out of having toys. And you read it to kids, and the kids don't really doesn't mean very much because nothing much happens. But parents who read it to their kids are completely overwhelmed by the emotion of it. And I would suggest that I'm not saying for 1 minute that Toy Story 3 won't work for kids. It will. It's got the full range of everything that you want from a kids' movie. It's got darkness. It's got scary creations. It's got this strange baby creature, which is really genuinely quite freaky. It's got humor. It's got a lovely thing about Barbie meeting Ken. It's got, you know, little musical sequences. All that stuff is there. But for an adult, it also has a really genuinely, properly, fully rounded sense of what it means to have grown from being a child into being an adult and still having that sense that you've put childish things away, but they still exist for it. I mean, I thought it was lovely. I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to say that it's better than Toy Story 2 because I still think that Toy Story 2 just hit every beat so clearly. But I must have seen Toy Story 2 40 or 50 times. I've only seen Toy Story 3 twice, both times in 3D. I want to go back and see it in 2D to see whether it makes any difference. But I think we all have to agree if this is officially the best movie trilogy of all time. I mean, I was trying to think if there's any movie trilogy that was equally successful. I started thinking, well, the Three Colors trilogy, you know, the Krzysztof Kieslowski. Well, yeah, but the white movie in that actually isn't very good. And as we've seen, Godfather went down the toilet. Shrek, even if they'd finished at number 3, obeys the laws of diminishing returns. I think this really is the best movie trilogy of all time.
And the 3D, it was better for that, was it?
Well, as I said, I've seen it twice in 3D, and I'd have to see it in 2D to make a decision. I remain unconvinced.
Oh, we know that.
3D.
We know that. We know that.
No, no,
we know
no,
generally
but,
you're unconvinced, but for this film, it worked.
But listen, but I am, yes, I am being more open-minded than I was. I concede that if I forgot I was watching it, it means that the artifice of the 3D did indeed, you know, fade away. Until I've seen it in 2D, I can't tell you whether it's better or worse. But what I can say is, as somebody, as you know, who has a massive aversion to 3D, it was the first film in which I wasn't actively alienated by the 3D.
Carol Crawford in Sydney, down under. Dear Buzz and Woody, being a regular podcast listener, oh, hello to Jason Isaacs, of course. I always enjoy listening to you on my Monday morning commute, which is what she's doing at the moment. You haven't saved my life at times. You have saved my sanity over the last couple of years. Went to see Toy Story 3 last week. Been a big fan of Pixar since Toy Story first blazed onto our screens and brought a new vision of computer-generated animation. Thankfully, Toy Story 3 has kept each of its installments of the franchise fresh and original with great heart and comedy. I laughed, I cried, and completely cracked up at Spanish Buzz and Mr. Potato Head as a tortilla and a cucumber. I trust Pixar will continue to make quality family animated movies. They've brought me countless joys with each of their movies, which get better with each viewing.
I tell you what, I am going to have nightmares about Mr. Potato Head as the tortilla, because although the big baby is really scary, there is something really freaky about Mr. Potato Head as a tortilla. And again, I think it's important that in the great tradition of children's literature, Toy Story doesn't shy away from, albeit in a completely approachable and an acceptable way, talking about dark, difficult subjects. I mean, it does abandonment and death and weirdness and all that stuff, but it does it in a way which is completely kid-friendly. It's proper children's literature on screen.
Speaking of death and weirdness, an email from Sarah Jane in Thamesmead about skeletons, which we've talked about for a bit.
Hello to Jason Isaacs.
Yes, well, she says, thank you, Wittertainment, for highlighting skeletons last week. She managed to queue up for a ticket and has seen it. I really enjoyed the film. She says, admired its ability to skillfully toe the line between being interestingly quirky and being up its own backside. Since more than one... This is the key bit for me. Since more than one of us were heard to mutter hello under our breath when Mr. Isaacs and his creepy scar came on screen, it's clear to me that there is great power in both Wittertainment and word of mouth. Perhaps the two could be greater combined to help skeletons get the attention it deserves. I just have this vision of a whole bunch of movie literate people going to see skeletons. There's Jason, everyone going. They don't want to say it too loudly because that would be crass and a little bit show offy. They just everyone mutters hello and then they move on. I like that.
Do I have time to say a very quick word about Katrin Breyat's Bluebeard, or are we out of time?
Well, I would say you've got a minute and a half.
Okay, fine. So Catherine Breyer, who's the person who did Romance, which wasn't at all romantic, Sexist Comedy, which wasn't at all funny, Amasur, which was very, very scary, and then that weird thing, Anatomy of Hell, which was hell indeed. Now she's done an adaptation of Bluebeard. I mention this because Toy Story, you know, Bluebeard, obviously famous a kid's fairy tale, the Charles Perrault story, and she's been quoted as saying, I read the story when I was 5 and a half. I think it's magnificent. It's influenced all my films. It's a fairy tale that I loved and reread constantly. But Breyer has this very sort of dark, I mean, many of her movies have been really sense-abating stuff. She's pushed the boundary in terms of what's acceptable, and I've often found her work really hard to like because there's such a sort of, you know, such a rough edge to it. Bluebeard, I think, is the most likable of all her films, but it says a lot that in being the most likable of her films, and it's an adaptation of a story which essentially is about, you know, somebody marrying a homicidal maniac, and it is, you know, it's a serial killer movie in the way that fairy tales often deal with that sort of stuff. It has all that Breyer strangeness and weirdness and corruption, but it seems on the outside to have sort of slightly smoother edges. I mean, I don't think that any Breyer movies are particularly likable. There's a playful sense in this which perhaps isn't in some of the rest of her work. It certainly looks very handsome, and I saw it a while ago now, I think it was at the London Film Festival, and certain images from it have definitely stuck in my mind. So it's, I think it's Catherine Breyer at her most easygoing, but that's not very easygoing.
So, movie of the week.
Well, Inception is just cracking. Toy Story 3 is really, really great, but because Toy Story 3, I think everyone's going to, you know, going to see enough. Go see Inception. Make Inception a huge hit. Prove that blockbusters can be really smart.
Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my Uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for video reviews, anecdotes, and the chance to let me know your opinions.